If you're visiting Lawrence, there are a few iconic places to check out. Allen Fieldhouse for a basketball game, after stopping by the Wheel for a drink, the Natural History Museum, Free State Brewery. But for international art scholars and art collectors, there's a much bigger draw: Roger Shimomura's studio. The artist has work in more than 90 museums nationwide, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Smithsonian, so he's kind of a big deal, and he's here to talk about his current exhibit, now showing at the Belger Art Center in Kansas City. He's joining us on KCUR Central Standard. Hi, Roger.
Hi.
So this show, An American Knockoff, tell me about it. What's the concept that unifies this show and this body of work?
Well, it's one of three themes that I've worked on for just about my entire career that has to do with ethnic identity. The other two were about the incarceration camps during World War II and stereotypes from World War II. But this one has to do with some of the issues that Asian Americans, mostly Japanese Americans, have faced since the since World War II, and still goes on today, I think.
Can you talk a little more about it still going on today?
Well, almost a week doesn't go by that I'm not asked where I'm from or, gee, you speak the language really well. The presumption that I'm a foreign, the presumption that if you're Asian, you must be foreign to this country.
In your current body of work, the idea of whether you are a part of the scene that you portray or somehow separate from it is, I think, a central question, because you paint yourself into scenes that are sort of chaotic with crowds often. And there are these iconic American characters in them, like Uncle Sam and Porky Pig. It's kind of like you're photobombing your own paintings. But are you doing that? Is your image appearing there as one of the crowd, someone who belongs in the crowd, or are you disrupting the scene? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think what I'm really doing is struggling. First of all, I make myself into the various stereotype that I'm frequently identified by, that is a martial artist. You know, if you're Asian, you must know martial arts. And I use that role to struggle with Walt Disney, who created a lifetime of stereotypes of not just Asian people, but of all ethnic groups. I struggle with the Chinese people and trying to separate myself from them, because it seems like so many of the public people feel as though there's no difference between Chinese and Japanese, here, there's a whole history of struggles and wars between the two countries. And, I grew up with a little bit of that in Seattle as a youngster and a familiar. I went to a school that was very racially diverse. And so I'm very sensitized to a lot of the issues that went on between various groups of Asian and Asian American people. So the paintings puts me as sort of the hero figure in there that's trying to get things straightened out. But first of all, identifying those people that myself as an Asian American has had difficulties with in the past.
You know, you alluded to this earlier, but a lot of your work has depicted scenes from an internment camp, actually what I call an internment camp, but I've noticed that you call it an incarceration camp. Before we get into your work depicting those scenes, I'm curious about your terminology choice.
Well, there's been a lot of investigation into the power of words. And first of all, the struggle was it a concentration camp or not? And there was a lot of issues that arose as soon as the Japanese-American community decided that they were concentration camps, one of the reasons being Franklin Roosevelt, who established those camps, himself referred to them as concentration camps. And also, by definition, internment camps is really a misnomer because it plays down the severity of it as being an incarceration camp. And internment was the term was mostly used for medical purposes, people that were isolated because they had a particular disease or medical issue, and so they were separated from the rest of the community. But it was primarily a way of softening what it actually was. I don't think the U.S. government wanted to be known or seen as one that put together concentration camps to incarcerate, you know, their own citizens.
You were in one of these camps when you were very young. How much do you remember from that experience?
Well, first of all, I've been very careful. If anything, I think my memories have become less and less because I've always been afraid of expanding upon the few memories that I do have, which primarily had to do with the severity of the weather conditions. I couldn't understand why leaving Seattle and moving to a desert in southern Idaho and what was a good option. All of the four seasons were so pronounced. It was the coldest I've ever been, the hottest I've ever been, the dirtiest from the dust and so on. And it was located on a lava bed. So you could imagine that, you know, physical circumstances of the camps were highly undesirable and very rough and raw. And that's primarily what I remember, although there are a few episodes such as getting measles in camp and being quarantined with my mother in a separate room, and we were quarantined for 2 to 3 weeks, and our food was passed through the slot in the door 3 times a day, and life was, I remember how incredibly boring it was because it was just the two of us in there. I can't imagine what my mother must have gone through during that period of time. But all of this is sort of cross-referenced by a diary that my grandmother kept, not just for the camp years, but for 56 years of her entire life in this country. She kept a diary. And a lot of my memories were corroborated by what she said in the diaries.
With those diaries and maybe conversations with your parents, I'm wondering what you know about the years and months leading up to that experience for your family. Do you know if it was a gradual process of ostracization or if things happened like quickly?
No, I think, it's hard to separate the kind of prejudice that they experienced prior to the war on whether, you know, there was any special type of prejudice towards being Asian. Of course, you know, they did have the Asian exclusion laws for quite a few years there. But, or whether it was similar to what all nationalities went through in one way or the other, you know, whether you were Italian or African-American or German-American or whatever. But certainly my grandfather, who was a cook at an Elks Club in 1907, talked about how when he would leave the restaurant late at night, there would be people standing there with rocks and would stone him. And so he finally had to leave through the back door and slip out by way of the alley in order to avoid being hurt. So, you know, to say whether that was happening to all Asian Americans or whether it was just happening to some is a little difficult to say.
How did the time in the camp come to an end? It sounds like you probably don't remember it firsthand, but do you know about just how it all ended?
Well, when they finally decided that we were not a threat. And, of course, they had completely disrupted our lives at that point since most of the 120,000 Japanese Americans that this involved had virtually given away or sold at ridiculously low prices everything that they owned, being as how they can only take with them to camp what they could carry. Most families, of course, have assets that are a lot larger, not to mention automobiles and houses and farms in particular. lost all of those things. And so after 2 to 3 years, when they gradually allowed the Japanese Americans to go back to their homes, they had nothing to go back to, and the climate, of course, was the political climate was very anti-Japanese. They were going to blame everything on them, and there were signs all over Seattle where we returned to, you know, that said, "Japs not welcome, go away, stay away, this is no longer your home," and things like that.
How did your family deal with that? I mean, as you said, having let go of all of your belongings, having 3 years of your lives kind
of... Well, they handled it a lot differently than I think my generation, you know, that later probably learned a lot from the African-American protest movement. But the Japanese went about it trying to prove... I could cite one very clear example, I think, and that's when a couple of years after we got back to Seattle, we went down to Cannon Beach, Oregon, from Seattle, for a one-week vacation. And we got down there, and it was my mother, father, and I was probably around 7 years old. And my father went in to register at this cabin. There were, I think, a series of 7 or 9 cabins. And then he came out after about 15 minutes and said the owner wouldn't rent to us because he didn't realize that we were Japanese. And my mom and dad sat outside of the car talking for the longest time. And then they both went back in, and after about another 15 minutes came out and just quietly drove to where all the cabins were. And there's one cabin that was further back into the woods that apparently was no longer taken care of for years. It was completely overgrown by weeds and was filthy because no one had used it in a long period of time. And my mom and dad went to the nearby grocery store, got cleaning equipment, came back and spent the entire day cleaning this cabin. And so we spent one day cleaning the cabin and then spent another 5 or 6 days trying to enjoy it. And we got back to Seattle after a week. And the following week after that, my father received a letter from the owner of that resort saying that he would no longer put restrictions on who we would rent to, and thank you for what you did and so on. And I think that that was kind of typical, the way that Japanese Americans did things following the war and how they fought that racism. You know, that's not to say that that was either the, you know, the best way or the quickest way to resolve things.
Yeah.
But, and certainly different than the way things happened after that. You know?
What does it mean to you to paint about those experiences and to share those paintings with other Americans decades later? Americans who might not have been, most of them, alive when this was all happening.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I've lectured when I was doing a series on, I call it my camp series. I went around the country lecturing at different museums. And when I went down to Jackson, Mississippi, no one believed me. No one believed that this happened because it wasn't in their history books. There are parts of Texas, the same thing. And of course, as I understand it, Texas is revising a lot of their textbooks. And one of the things that they're going to eliminate is any kind of education about the camps. So, you know, we'll have generations coming from the state of Texas that's not going to know anything about this and how close this whole current day Muslim issue is to what the Japanese Americans went through. But depending on what part of the country you are, of course, on the West Coast, where it is in their history books, and a lot of people have connections to families that were directly involved in the evacuation, don't need the kind of education that people in other parts of the country do. So I don't think enough emphasis is placed upon the fact that a lot of this all depends upon where you live and the level of sophistication that you have concerning this issue.
Because you've got firsthand storytelling going on in a lot of parts of the country?
Yes.
Well, yes. Roger Shimomura, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Roger's painting exhibition, which originated in a Seattle gallery, is now on view at the Belger Arts Center. It'll be there until late January, and we'll have the information on that show on our website with this interview. That'll be at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Earlier in the show, we talked about evidence versus allegations in journalism and what's at stake for democracy. Keep talking about that on Twitter. We want to hear what you have to say. We're at KCUR. CST. Tomorrow, tune in for a chat with Patricia Lockwood. Last time we spoke, she'd been dubbed poetry's smut queen by the New York Times. Now she's got a memoir coming out. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Aaron Pelish and Raven Brooks. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next. Don't miss it.